The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, let's just face it. A lot of people right now are demoralized because gold hasn't done what they thought it would do in the time that they thought it would do it. You know, and I understand what they're saying because the signals that are coming in right now would make a person think that gold should be skyrocketing.
Kevin, last week my son offered this simple prayer. It was breakfast and he said, "Lord, may the price of gold go up." And I thought, well, I agree with you, but I don't know if God listens to those kinds of prayers. Maybe he does. I don't know. But it was interesting. It was sort of followed on this week by a comment from my oldest son, because I told him, hey, the price of gold was down $14 earlier this week. And he says, "Well, that's great. Yes." And just such great enthusiasm. I thought, well, what are you thinking? I mean, what are your thoughts? And he's like, "Well, I'm going to wait until it's $1 an ounce. And when it's $1 an ounce, then I can buy 1,000 ounces. and it made me smile because he does get it, that lower prices are intriguing if you're not finished purchasing. And he's not finished purchasing. In fact, he hasn't even begun.
Right.
So he's looking at it as a positive thing. I just said, you know, it's going to be difficult to hit those numbers. And I think you're right. There are a lot of people who say, well, gosh, on my time frame, my expected time frame, gold has not traded in the direction I hoped it would in the time frame I hoped it would.
Yeah.
And I would boil it down to something really simple. Keep it very simple because it is this simple. Number one, money printing has never worked in the history of mankind.
Never. Yeah, there's no occasion of that.
In fact, it's as axiomatic. The other side of that is money printing, this is point number two, has always led to inflation.
Right.
And again, it doesn't matter if it's immediate inflation or a lagging basis, because typically you will see asset price inflation before you see consumer price inflation. And sure enough, what do we have already? We have money printing to the tune of $10 trillion, which is in the pipeline via all the world's central banks.
Yes, but Dave, what if this time it's different? What if the central banks have finally figured out a way to print unlimited amounts of money and it always have the same buying power?
And that may be the case. They may have cracked the code. They may have, through all kinds of different new technologies, created a way of sterilizing the creation of new money. Now, I mean, maybe I'm stuck in the old days where sterilizing meant one thing, but this is interesting. They assume that $10 trillion is not going to move the needle in terms of inflation.
Yeah, and you know, I was being sarcastic when I asked that question. You can't. You know, when we were kids, we were told money does not grow on trees. Now, a central banker is going to argue with that. They're going to say, you know, it doesn't necessarily take a tree, but we can certainly add zeros anytime we want.
So here's my basic summary. This is the conversation I had with my oldest son. He amended his projected price. He said, well, fine, I'll wait until it's $15 an ounce. And we weren't talking about silver. And he's not a young Harry Dent either. So, you know, $15 an ounce for gold. I just said, yeah, I don't know that you're going to see that. But do aggressively buy on any price weakness and make sure you have very clear goals in terms of the number of ounces that you want to have, because you're going to reach those goals a lot faster at cheaper prices. Just a few years ago, I had done that with a silver position, deciding how many ounces as a lifetime goal. And it was a fairly lofty goal. Granted, silver was $36, $37 an ounce. So I projected how many dollars it would take, how much savings, how many months, how many years it would take for me to reach my long-term lifetime ounce goal. And it was a little bit discouraging because I figured, well, this really is a lifetime goal.
Right.
And I've been able to speed that process up. And frankly, every time the price of silver takes a hit, I think to myself, this is intriguing. I get to add that many more ounces with less money involved. I like this. I'm getting closer to my lifetime goal. Now, why is that important to me? Ultimately, it's important to me because the number of ounces that I own today are not the number of ounces that I'm going to own tomorrow. And I've already done the math to say ounces are going to basically be cut in half. Maybe the math is a little bit different for each family, but I know that there's going to be a reduction in exposure to gold and silver as and when its purchasing power of other assets, whether that's stocks, bonds, real estate, is compelling. We've talked about the Dow gold ratio. In years past, we've even talked about the gold house ratio. Well, you can come up with your own ratio for any asset relative to gold. And when the purchasing power of gold in terms of that other asset is at a compelling level, you should be selling ounces
right,
and moving on to that asset class. The problem we have today is that it's not compelling enough. Yes, we've shifted dramatically from a 43-to-1 Dow Gold ratio to a 13-to-1 Dow Gold ratio. So you've made some progress, and here we are stuck in the mud for the last 2.5-3 years. But I think more progress is going to be made. And even at a 13-to-1 Dow Gold ratio, I think it's a compelling purchase relative to where we're going to end up in terms of purchasing power and ultimately translating into other assets in a net worth statement.
Well, and you know, Dave, I like to sometimes picture this and talk to people about picturing it as four bowls sitting in front of you. And I'd like to talk about all four bowls on this conversation today. Bowl number one, you can put your money in the stock market. Okay, last week you pointed out that stocks are down 70% still, even at new highs, relative to gold ounces over the last few years. So bowl number one doesn't necessarily look great, but that's one of the options. Bowl number two is the bond market or interest rates. Basically, we're looking at bonds. You can loan governments money. They're not paying much interest right now, but if the interest rates rise, the bonds will go down. So bowl number one is stocks. Bowl number two is bonds. Bowl number three is currencies. You can just keep your money in cash. You and I have talked before that cash is valuable, but the problem is it's losing value on an annual basis. We haven't had a deflation or an actual revaluation of cash in buying power since we went off the gold standard. And then you've got the fourth bowl, the golden bowl. You can put your money in gold. So you can put it into stocks, bonds, currency, or gold. Now, I'm not counting real estate in this conversation. I'm talking about liquid assets.
Yeah, exactly. You're not talking about any illiquid assets, which could be privately listed companies, a company that you operate yourself, or real estate,
sure,
or a business partnership of some sort, or private equity fund or hedge fund where you're very limited in terms of your access to the capital. You're talking about liquid assets and sort of four general allocations.
Right. We've seen the stock market nominally hitting new highs. Yet, you know, income here in America hasn't risen. So if income isn't rising in an economy, the only other way to make something grow is to borrow it, right? I mean, that's credit growth if you don't see income growth in the economy.
Well, you're right. And the way you've just broken that down into the four sort of bowls or categories, if you will, we did something similar at Fort Lewis College when we were talking about a reallocation strategy several years ago. And instead of bowls, what was proposed is buckets, you know, the buckets that you put your resources into. Well, household sector balance sheets. This is something that's very intriguing in terms of figuring out where we're at in a long period of time, a long continuum of time, relative to other peaks, relative to other troughs. Are we at a low point? Are we at a high point? $26 trillion has been added to household net worth since 2009.
But is it our household or is it the fraction of 1% that are becoming extraordinarily wealthy?
I think that's probably the distortion in the figures is it's not sort of a median number, a mid number, averaging out all households. This is total household, which would include the sort of, you know, 0.01%, which have done extraordinarily well. And that does not include sort of the 65%, most of the middle class entailed in that, that frankly have not done so well. In fact, they've seen since the beginning of the millennium about a 1/3 cut in their net worth. So this is the contrast. If you look at median net worth, right, you've gone from 80-something thousand, and you can cut about 30% off of that, a good $20,000, $25,000 less in terms of median net worth.
So it's hollowing out the middle class, but you have the very rich getting very richer.
And yet, we are at a record high of $82 trillion in terms of household sector balance sheets. That is all of your household net worth. And yes, that is distorted by the 0.1% or the 1/100th or the 1/1000th of 1%, if you will.
Well, let's look at some of the markets then. Okay, I mentioned the four bowls, but let's look at real estate first. Okay, how much has real estate risen in relative terms to, say, income or household net worth?
Okay, its best days were 2005 and 2006. So it was selling at even higher premiums relative to disposable income. Now it's at about a 12.5% premium. If you're looking at sort of the average, you know, what does real estate represent on someone's balance sheet?
Now, when we talk about premiums, we're talking about how much more it's worth relative to the growth of household net worth, correct?
Well, Kevin, let me back up for just a minute, because what you were saying earlier about income driving the economy, this is very, very critical, because income is an indication of how well people are doing, how well families are doing. And as income increases, your ability to do more and varied things in the economy is expanded, whether that's buying a second car, whether that's sending your kids to private school, whether that's increasing your food budget, whether that's buying a second home. I mean, there's all these things that with increased income, income you get to do, okay? And so income becomes relevant to sort of understanding net worth, savings, etc. If you go back to, say, the 1950s and looked at disposable income, and then looked at these asset classes, real estate, relative to disposable income. Today, it's at about a 12%, 12.5% premium to the average. Okay, so we're a little bit above the average in terms of real estate values compared to disposable income.
Well, and real estate is real stuff. Let's talk about stocks then, because stocks are hitting new nominal highs. Where does that factor in?
Well, it depends. If you look at just stocks, again, if you're looking at someone's equity portfolio and what does that represent relative to their income, you have this average, what it has represented on lots of people's balance sheets from 1952 to the present. And that gives us some bearing. Are we on the high side or the low side? We're currently in the equity market about a 43% premium relative to disposable income. That is unless you also include mutual funds. Then including mutual funds puts you at about a 78% premium to the average dating back to 1952.
So that would mean that it's overvalued based on averages.
It's overvalued. And in fact, when you're looking at either of those figures, you're looking at numbers that we haven't seen since the year 2000. And 2000 was the most exaggerated that we'd seen in stock market history.
And that was the crash year.
Precisely. So you could say, well, we're doing very well. Yes, we are doing very well. The incomes, again, are a really helpful guide in appreciating what drives an economy. Mm. Without income growth, it's hard to justify market expansion. So when you see major expansion in the marketplace with no commensurate income growth, you can look first, if you want an explanation, to the leverage numbers.
Which is borrowed money.
Exactly. Because if it's not income that's driving it, what is driving it? What is the borrowing that's financing that growth? It could be government borrowing. It could be corporate borrowing. It could be household sector debt. And that's growing in the place of income growth. That's the problem, because ultimately that's not expanding. Households are expanding their percentage of credit as of this week. And it's all on the basis of 0% financing. Hmm. Think about this. You're a clunker. You just want to quit paying for, sounds like my wife. She says, I don't want to take the car to the auto shop again. I just don't want to do it.
Right.
You know, this time it was a seatbelt. Not a big deal, except that we have kids and we need to keep them buckled in, right? So it's a necessity. We are going to get it fixed.
And then somebody comes along and says, hey, you want a new one? And no financing charges whatsoever.
This is the temptation.
Yeah.
Rather than being nickeled and dimed over the things that we fix on our routine basis on our car, we are tempted to finance it on 0% interest. And so, you know, looking at the consumer spending numbers recently, autos have been up. On what terms? Cash? No. 0% financing. And it's interesting to see throughout the economy a number of companies that have sort of an internal finance wing. Conn's is a department store, not really a department store, but an electronics and furniture store in the South, headquartered in Texas, but they have places all over the country. And they've done 0% financing for 36 months for their clients for many, many years now. And that has given them super growth. I mean, super growth. But essentially, they're no longer in the electronics business. They're in the subprime lending business.
Mm-hmm.
And that subprime lending business has increased their stock price from $3.39 up to over $77 a share just since 2010. Now, all of a sudden, people aren't paying. They've expired their 36 months of free money, and they don't have the money to pay. At the same time, they've had groceries that have gone up, and they've had rent which has gone up. And the question is, you still need groceries, you still need a roof over your head, do you still need the extra flat screen? And the first payment missed is to this subprime market. So we've seen an expansion of household debt and consumer credit. But what's interesting is it's on very dangerous terms, because it suckers everyone into, I can have it now, even though I can't afford it now. And again, this is, I think, where we begin to see problems. It's not sustainable growth. Income growth, now that's a different story. If we were seeing income growth driving the economy, hats off to the growth that we'd see in GDP. But that's not where it's coming from. It's coming from very frail consumer credit growth.
Well, and it's interesting. The government is the encourager of the low interest rates. You know, the ZIRP policy, the zero interest rate policy that we've talked about before. But, you know, it creates ultimately an issue when you no longer have the borrower who's coming in and borrowing at 0%. Let's say that at the retail store that you were talking about. then you have to have somebody who creates that money. If income doesn't create the money, an increase in income, and if people are not able to pay back their credit, then a government has to print money. Now, inflation, you talked about that earlier. Inflation is something that occurs when you print money. Now, there is talk right now, some pretty big names coming out and saying, oh, inflation's dead. Don't you understand? That's a thing of the past.
It's a consensus understanding. I mean, such a strong consensus that I would venture to say if you interviewed 50 economists, 49 of them would say inflation's not a concern, nor will it be, which made Ken Rogoff's article last week very intriguing, saying, no, it's dormant. Don't ever forget this, that again, it doesn't matter what professionals believe about inflation. It's ultimately what happens in the political process and as a result of social choice that, listen, the era of modern central banking cannot deliver to you an inflation-free environment forever, particularly when you're printing like mad. His simple conclusion was that it's dormant, but it will not remain so forever.
You know, it reminds me, okay, we're coming into the Christmas season, and I know my kids are really looking forward to the third movie of The Hobbit coming. Okay, Smaug the Dragon had been dormant for years, but he's going to get awakened and very, very angry here, I think, as we come into this last movie. And, you know, inflation, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago, you talked to Adam Ferguson. That was his warning. You know, what happens when a dormant inflation rate, which in Germany back in the early 20s, if you'll recall, it was running about 2 to 3 to 4% before it exploded into the billions of percent, literally a collapse of the currency.
A money manager that I keep track of from time to time, we've met up at different conferences here and there, usually in New York, he likes to say that in a democratic political system with a fiat currency, all roads lead to inflation. And it's just, again, going back to the basics, you can look and say money printing has never worked in the history of mankind. And money printing has always led to inflation. These are very simple axioms. But, you know, you throw in the political dynamic that in a democracy where people are going to vote their self-interest with a government that has access to an entirely fiat currency, all roads lead to inflation.
Yeah.
Again, what's the time frame for that? Well, that's where I think there's certainly frustration, justifiably so. When do we see inflation? Do we see it tomorrow? Do we see it next week? Do we see it next year? Do we see it in 2025? Do we see it in 2075 when, frankly, none of us give a rip? Well, this is the problem. Timing is never precise in these issues because it's trickle down. You have a policy that's implemented, like we've had with QE3. And QE2 before it and QE1 before it. And it does something in the marketplace. It gave us asset price inflation. We've already begun to see consumer price inflation. And that's why we're beginning to see those subprime borrowers make tough choices.
They're running out of money, Dave. They have to borrow at 0%. They can't buy things these days.
And my point is they're having to prioritize.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we've already seen rent inflation. We've already seen food inflation, and one of the ways that you've seen food inflation is what they're now calling shrinkflation.
It's the smaller box.
It's the smaller box.
Yeah, the Kraft macaroni and cheese is getting smaller and smaller.
At the end of the month, for the same calories, you are having to increase your food budget. And even though you don't have sticker shock when you're buying the same box of Kraft macaroni, there is still inflation. So it is trickling through.
Well, and you know, okay, let's go ahead and look at what Draghi did last week, because after our show last week, Mario Draghi, you know, we can say shocked the markets by lowering interest rates, but I think it was somewhat expected. You know, gold went down relative to the dollar because the dollar went way up, but it was interesting. We looked that day at the other currencies, you know, the euro and the yen. Gold was rising against the euro, against the yen.
And against the British pound.
Against the pound. But yeah, let's look at the pound for a second.
Next week is the vote on Scottish independence, which is pressuring the pound in lockstep with what Draghi has done to pressure the euro lower to increase trade competitiveness. We suggested this precisely last week before Draghi's announcement, but again, not with any foreknowledge that he was going to do it next week, just that he was going to do it eventually and bully the price of the euro lower, which would benefit the dollar. It has benefited the dollar, and as it's benefited the dollar, it's hurt gold in dollar terms. It has not hurt gold in other currency terms, however. That's because we've seen a major decline in other currencies. So the rest of the world looks and says, gold's going up, gold's going up, gold's going up. This is a perspectival appraisal on our part to say gold's just gone down, because it's not going down universally on the basis of supply and demand. It's being reflected such by the weakness in a currency and the way it's traded on that basis.
So David, this Scottish independence vote, what does that do for European integration as a whole? I mean, we have heard rumblings of various countries saying, you know, maybe we ought to just break away. What is this saying?
You know, the euro's already under pressure, and maybe it survives, maybe it doesn't. But the Scottish independence vote casts a shadow over European integration by suggesting to other separatist movements that there is a course for them to take. There is a course forward. So you've got Catalonia, you've got Northern Italy just being two, and there's others that are sort of simmering under the surface. And the challenge would be to sort out, in Scotland anyways, the currency and then the independent fiscal management. And then that is easier said than done. We've already witnessed a monetary union in Europe, and that's been very tough for the European countries, particularly the peripheral European countries. That may be an option for Scotland, to join Europe via the EMU, the European Monetary Unit, or perhaps they could convince London to allow them to maintain the pound. The challenge is, again, it's creating the same policy difficulties already witnessed in Europe. You don't have a fiscal policy that's unified. You've got divergent national interests at the level of currency and monetary management. And it's just, frankly, it's difficult to imagine that in London, in Westminster, it's difficult to imagine them allowing the retention of the pound sterling in Scotland, unless it was, of course, for them to sort of leave the door open to reintegration 5-10 years out, if a fresh vote is taken and sort of inclusion is desired more than separatist tendencies right now.
Well, and it seems like the pot of nationality and these integrations is being stirred pretty dramatically right now. Look at Putin, okay? Somebody said a few shows ago that Putin's putting the band back together again. Yeah, that's true, but that has limits, doesn't it?
Well, you know, reliving the glory days of Mother Russia, that's not entirely possible. You've got the Baltic states and you've got Poland, where NATO and EU integration has already occurred. And that would be like a divorced couple that's already been remarried. Some options have already been taken off the table. You can't sort of go back to the original spouse without it being very, very, very messy. So again, some options have been taken off the table. But there's other countries. We mentioned, you know, the conflict brewing between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the area close to the Baku-Tbilisi pipeline.
And George Friedman said Belarus is another target. I mean, Ukraine and Belarus.
Right. So you've got Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, all of those are potential candidates for reintegration into the Russian network. There's, again, some things that they've lost at the end of the Cold War that they're not going to get back. Obviously, East Germany is gone. So in terms of a GDP contributor, Russia is diminished by having lost this access to, you know, a larger sphere of influence.
Poland has seemed nervous, though. I mean, let's face it, Poland is watching the response from the West.
I watched something on the internet the other day. It was a friend sent to me, and it basically was a time-lapse photography of a European map going back to 1200. And it was fascinating, because what they did is in 3 minutes, they covered the time span from 1200 to the present, and you get to see how often these lines that we draw and assume that, you know, leaders are prospectively drawing, what land would they like to have? It is absolutely amazing. It's like looking through a kaleidoscope. The things that change on a constant basis, all of Europe has been shifting, and borders have been shifting constantly from 1200 forward. So is Poland nervous? Yes, they're nervous. But again, I think that was a major loss. The Czech Republic's, East Germany, those were GDP losses for Russia. The U.S. policy today is very interesting. The U.S. policy, as it relates to Russia, is creating a tremendous amount of military insecurity.
Well, and Russia is historically militarily insecure. They're always on, at least in their own minds, the defense.
And the military insecurity is something that I want to come back to. It's sort of the next Cold War move for us to make, is not only to create or exaggerate the military insecurity that Russia is already feeling, but it is to smother the price of oil for the next 6 to 12 months. If we intend to fight an economic war and a sanction war, not a military war, against Russia than it would be following the same step sequence we did during the Cold War, which is, number one, we could outspend them, of course. And number two, we could drive the price of oil down. And yes, that can be done over the short term, manipulating prices lower. And that would bring Putin, in theory, to heel via the state's oil revenues being diminished considerably.
It's key that you're bringing the Cold War back up again, because NATO, when we were growing up, Dave, NATO was a military cooperation organization. It was military only. Now, for the last 20 years or so, it's been a political organization. It's more politics than anything. But with this rapid deployment force that's been decided on, are we seeing NATO go back to a military organization?
You had the decision in Wales just last week to deploy 4,000 rapid deployment fighters. And the significance was not because of the manpower commitment. 4,000 is nothing compared to Russia's million-man army. But it assumes an infrastructure commitment, which, coming from comments from Stephen Cohen at New York University, and I think he spent 30-odd years teaching contemporary Russian politics at Princeton before that. He's not Stephen Cohen, the hedge fund guy. But he suggested that, listen, when you're making infrastructure commitments, you're really saying that you're building military bases, and we're talking about building them in the Baltic republics. We're talking about Poland. We're talking about Romania.
That is right in the backyard of Russia.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Western military alliance right to the front door of Russia, which is what I meant earlier by creating military insecurity. So the transition is a critical one. The transition in Wales was from the political expansion of NATO over the last 20 years to the military expansion of NATO. And Putin will feel very differently about this one.
Well, do you have a prediction? When you're talking about Putin feeling differently, what does that mean? This is a man who can't really go back. He can't really back down. Politically, that would be suicide.
I think he plays more aggressively. I think he's willing to spend from the treasury and even exhaust the treasury if oil does come under attack, as we mentioned earlier. If we're to smother the price of oil and try to bankrupt him, he will use state funds and he will use any means possible to fight on the terms that we're fighting him. I think one of the things that this assumes is that he will also increase asymmetrical warfare. The notion that whether it is terrorist organizations that are funded, keep in mind, most, if not all, of your terrorist organizations were funded by the Soviets in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Right. It was the AK-47 rule. When you watch TV, if they had AK-47s, they were financed by Russia.
Right. You could go anywhere in the world, whether it was Latin America, the Middle East. It was not the ideology of religion driving extremism. It was the extremism of political ideology that was driving the funding of terrorism, bringing about a certain political end. And the ends obviously justify the means in the communist mindset. So would we see more asymmetrical warfare funded by the Russians? Sure. Would we see things like cyber attacks on the increase? Absolutely. Absolutely. Could we expect to see not only JP Morgan hacked, as they have been recently, but most of your Fortune 500 companies come under attack? Do your Fortune 500 companies have adequate security, internet security? No, they don't. And so could you see the likes of GE and GE Capital, the likes of Bank of America? I mean, your major banks, but then your non-bank, but major multinational corporations dealing with hacks that bring them to their knees. Absolutely. And you're talking about something that would debilitate the U.S. equity market and debilitate the U.S. economy, costing us billions, even tens or hundreds of billions of dollars as a consequence.
Well, and not even the U.S. economy only. Let's go ahead and look at the European economy, because really, Draghi is lowering interest rates. He's loosening the policy. He's getting away with a lot of things that really don't cause any real structural change. I mean, Europe is still a mess. America is still a mess, but we've sort of bought the last 5 or 6 years with quantitative easing. Now, what if, okay, and again, looking at what's going on in Russia, these things that are going on in the Middle East, the thing that's interesting to me is if you have not structurally fixed the problem, then when something happens, let's say it is a hack or something that happens that's outside of the central banker's control, then you've created all this money, you've created all this band-aid to go over these problems, but you haven't fixed anything structurally.
And I think that's one of the concerns, if I were Ken Rogoff, that I would be looking at too. You've got Adair Turner, who was the former chairman of the UK Financial Services Authority. He's a member of the Financial Policy Committee in the United Kingdom and is a member of the House of Lords. is quite interesting. What Mr. Turner was suggesting is that the Eurozone faces these major structural and fiscal reforms. And even though Draghi is promising the sun, moon, and stars with his most recent announcement, it does not even begin to touch the kinds of change that need to happen in the Eurozone. And so Mr. Turner's suggestion, and this is to quote him, optimal policy may therefore require a non-transparent fudge. Monetary and fiscal coordination might mean, after the fact, permanent monetary finance, but without ever openly admitting that possibility.
Well, now, I wonder how you do that, though, because the Germans don't want to see these things. There are laws against Draghi doing some of the things he's doing, and he's talking now about non-transparent action, isn't he?
Well, he's saying a couple of things which I think are very intriguing. Number one, that the kinds of asset securities purchases that Draghi is committing to, $906 billion worth of new purchases, it's not going to change the structural stuff. And so any of the fiscal deficits that have to be run will be directly financed, will have to be monetized. So this is the real critical point, coming back to where we're at in the cycle of things. Nothing has been changed structurally in Europe or the United States to the degree where we can walk away from monetizing bad debts. Monetizing fiscal deficits and not announcing it. Yes, okay, Mr. Turner's right. You're avoiding political risks if you keep it quiet. But what you're not going to avoid is the axiomatic inflation risks of monetary finance. Because remember, when you start monetizing the deficit, you are creating something attuned to supercharged inflation. I mean, this has been tried so many times in financial history. It's almost boring, but it's in this instance, again, being ignored, being looked over by the world's economists saying, you know, inflation's not here. The Financial Service Authority, member of the Financial Policy Committee, House of Lords, is saying basically, not only is this the necessary course, you're going to have to do it quietly. And he's not even considering the inflation risks.
Well, he's saying create inflation, tell no one.
Tell no one. And yeah, maybe he's just stating the obvious, that Mr. Draghi will do what he thinks best and ask forgiveness, not permission, if his market maneuvering is ever brought into the light of day. And as you mentioned earlier, this will be to the chagrin of the German central bank and anyone with a recollection that monetary finance is a deadly game and has consequences for everyone in society. That was the point of our conversation with Adam Ferguson, is that monetary financing, you know, when you're financing deficits and printing money just to do that, to pay for current and sort of recycled debts, this is how inflation gets out of control very quickly. For the time being, here we are. We sit back and we're witness to historic decisions in Europe to take rates from negative to even more negative. That was one of the ECB's decisions, Mario Draghi's announcements. He was already running negative rates, and then he doubled down, if you will. And then in addition to that, he's going to take the ECB balance sheet back towards $3 trillion. That's something we've been saying for over a year now, that the ECB balance sheet was shrinking even as the Fed's was on the rise. And this would ultimately allow the ECB the flexibility of going back to sort of re-leveraging.
Well, let me ask, though, we've talked about a lot of American companies who have their money overseas, okay? And they have their money overseas, not necessarily in dollars. It can be in euros. How does this affect the bottom line of these multinational businesses?
The bottom line is if their revenues are being generated in euros and British pounds, and we're talking about a context in which the British pound and the euro are both going down, then the portion of their revenues which are generated in those currencies, if they're not adequately hedging them, and very few of them have adequate hedges, they're going to take a major hit to their earnings. So you could say that Q2 was sort of the last goodbye to good news from the multinationals. As we move into Q3 reporting, and certainly the second half as we finish Q4, your multinationals are going to be bleeding because this is major currency volatility.
There's a change in the wind, though. Okay, we had quantitative easing. Let's go ahead and use another type of Q. Quantitative easing, QE1. QE2, QE1, every time they came out and added QE, it caused the stock market to explode. Every time they ended it, it fell.
Explode in the sense that it went higher.
Oh, it meant higher. Yeah, but QE3. Okay, we're seeing QE3 tapered down to nothing here. Okay, the end is supposed to be in sight in October. How come we're not seeing the reaction that we saw at the end of QE1 and the end of QE2?
Yeah, it's interesting because the consensus view is that it will be different this time. QE1 ended poorly. QE2 ended poorly. QE3 will end perfectly. And that's really the market's behavior today. The market seems, to be reveling in the bliss of complacency. And I don't fully understand this. Is it absent-mindedness? Is it, again, as we suggested last week, sort of pinned to the faith in the Federal Reserve? Yes, they have powers, but they're not all that magisterial. And, you know, it makes me smile somewhat uncomfortably thinking about our very candid conversation with William White earlier in the year. I think that was February of this year, that central banking is not a science, and that central bankers get it wrong as much or more than they get it right, which is critical to realize if you're presently in a camp that assumes that the Fed is in complete control of outcomes. And again, as we get to the end of the taper, the end of this month and move into October, that somehow this time is different. The end of QE3 will not cause a complete sell-off in the stock market because this time is different.
Well, and you know, for the person who's tried to bet against this being real fact, this central bank control, let's face it, Dave, the people who are printing the money have been able to spank them every time they do something. It's like getting a spanking. You go out and buy some gold and you say, you know, I think there's going to be inflation in the future. And then bang, you get a spanking on the price. You can do this with interest rates. We can do this with the stocks. The only people who are really making money right now are the people who are betting that the central banks have 100% control. Now, what kind of risk is that? I mean, if we're really sitting on the two pillars of the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, how solid are those pillars?
You have to go back and listen to the interview with William White. Go through our archives and find that. I believe it was February, maybe February 14th. Maybe I just loved it so much that I'm attaching it to Valentine's Day. I don't know. But it was back in that time frame that we interviewed William White. And it was obvious, whether it's the ECB or the Fed as the twin pillars holding up the hope and expectations of the masses in the markets or other central banks around the world, at what point in history has money printing been the solution?
Name one.
Can't think of any.
Right.
And following that, at what point in history has money printing not led to inflation?
Name one.
And again, we mentioned this earlier, the collective efforts of the world central banks, $10 trillion.
Okay, now adding $10 trillion, the central banks over the last how many years? 5, 6 years?
Uh-huh.
That's like taking a city of 10 million people and handing each one $1 million. That's making 10 million new millionaires. If you just printed out of thin air and handed it to them, that's amazing.
But there's not going to be an inflation event. The expectations of inflation are, as the Fed likes to say, well anchored. It's not without surprise that at the same time we see expectations of inflation at zero in the context of rampant money printing, $10 trillion worth, that we also have what's called the Investors Intelligence Poll. I know it sounds like an oxymoron. Investors Intelligence Poll, it reaches a 27-year extreme where those who are bearish in the stock market, that is those who are thinking that the stock market will go down, are at 13.3%. That's the lowest level since the summer of 1987.
So 13 people out of 100, let's even be generous, let's say 13 to 14 people out of 100 believe that the stock market can go down. Now, I started with your family in the summer of 1987, and your dad was pointing this same thing out. He said, this is crazy.
Investor confidence is off the charts.
We had the worst crash that fall that we had had since 1929.
Well, confidence is at very high levels, as high as it has ever been. And frankly, it's not a bad thing if prices and sentiment are unidirectional. If they can only go one direction, then the fact that they've gone high, maybe we can assume they'll only go higher from here. But one thing we do know about price and sentiment in the marketplace is that they are what they call mean reverting. They go up and they go down and they hug this mean, this middle point. Sometimes you have over exuberance in the marketplace and sometimes you have over pessimistic views in the marketplace. And right now we are tapping that never been more enthusiastic ever number, 13.3%. Well, I should say it hasn't been that enthusiastic in 30 years.
Isn't it strange though, the divergence between people's feeling about the overall economy and the stock market? Probably some of the same people being polled think the stock market's only going to go up for forever, yet they will say that the economy absolutely stinks.
Well, again, you go back to that $82 trillion number, $26 trillion in wealth created since 2009. And try to square those numbers. Keep that in mind. Okay. Just hold those numbers in one part of your brain. George Washington University poll released this week has 70% of Americans believing that the country is headed the wrong direction. You can compare that to last month, a poll from NBC News, Wall Street Journal, it was a dual poll that showed 71% of Americans think that as a country, we're on the wrong track. 64% are dissatisfied with the economy. 79% are down on the U.S. political system. 76% with a real lack of confidence that the next generation will have a better life than the last one. Listen to this. How do you square these numbers well north of 50%? With the stock market being at all-time highs and real estate having recovered? What I'm saying is that when you think about a $26 trillion bonus, it was a Fed gift to the ultra-rich, and it was a Fed gift to the banks. So this is not something that is sort of well spread out amongst the hoi polloi, amongst the average Joe and Susie lunchbox. There is a gap between the realities faced by the man on the street and the bankers at the Fed that maintain credibility with the Wall Street denizens. I mean, the growth in asset prices, this goes back to that idea of income. The growth in asset prices has far exceeded the growth in the economy. We've had stagnant wages, stagnant real wages for a long time now.
So it's not sustainable.
It's not. When you see asset prices go up and you haven't had an increase in income, something that is fundamental to driving the economy further, growth in equities, growth in real estate, they've outpaced the growth in income. It begs the basic question all over again. If income is not the economy, are we safe to assume that central bank printing is really the new cure-all? Is that what the future success of America is based on? Not manufacturing, not jobs growth, not innovation, but money printing? Really?
So Dave, you've pointed out before, anytime money's printed, it turns to inflation. Anytime there's inflation, gold goes up. What's your comfort level right now as to holding your gold?
I would say anytime there's inflation, gold will play catch up. It's not on a day-to-day basis. Let's say the inflation figures peak up tomorrow. Does gold axiomatically go up that same day? Nope. In fact, it can go a long period of time before it is realized by the general public that they need an inflation protector. And then they will go to gold, and that's when you begin to see, again, inflation. I think you can see inflation numbers move higher and higher and higher, and then gold play catch up as people try to remedy the circumstance they find themselves in. So I remain very comfortable owning gold and adding to positions every chance I get. And this is back to that dinner table conversation I mentioned. Gold was down $14. And my eldest son says, yes, you know, I want it to be a dollar. I can own 1,000 ounces. It was a great conversation. But what we talked about was the importance of a low cost basis in an investment. And I argued that we had passed the Rubicon at four digits.
So when it hit 1,000, that was passing the Rubicon.
Yeah. And gold below $1,000, let alone a dollar, was a very low probability. Of course, then I had to explain Caesar's crossing the river and setting in motion a series of events which could not be undone. His actions, you may recall, led to a civil war. So the kids know it, in my view, the die is cast, as Caesar said. Higher gold prices are in their future as a consequence of monetary and fiscal policy missteps.
Well, and we can angrily talk about what the central bankers are doing. We can angrily talk about what's happening in politics. But Dave, politicians and central bankers and Wall Street, they can't really be heroes in this situation and actually go in and fix something, can they? Because they'll be thrown out of office.
That's what it would take, though. And funny you mentioned that. Stephen Roach, just at the end of August, he said, this is a time for heroes, not cheerleaders. Mm. And no, I don't think we have politicians who are heroes, who are willing to sacrifice their political careers to do the right thing. Myopic authorities, says Stephen Roach, need less guidance from frothy financial markets, and they need to focus more on structural repair of a post-crisis world. This is a time for heroes, not cheerleaders. But you know exactly what we have? We have cheerleaders. We've got Morgan Stanley, Stephen Roach's alma mater, mine as well. This week, they're projecting 50% growth in the S&P. That's supported by UPenn Finance Department. You remember Jeremy Siegel, who wrote the book Stocks for the Long Run?
Right.
Oh, we're going to finish the year at 18,000 on the Dow, he says. That's possible. But the question is, are we getting to levels that are sustainable? Are we getting to levels that are justifiable? And for Stephen Roach, a veteran economist with Morgan Stanley, to have walked away from the business, he's teaching now in the Yale Economics Department, to say, guys, we haven't fixed anything structurally. We haven't even begun. Where are the heroes? Where are the people who are implementing structural reforms? Where are the people who are putting in place fiscal restraint necessary to bring us back into line with where the economy is actually growing or not growing. We're still living beyond our means.
But Dave, okay, I'm going to play the role right now of the person who cannot earn an income on their interest. They're retired. They really don't have rental properties. They don't have other means of income. And they're looking at you and they're saying, you know, I understand this. I get it. The stock market's too high. But I think I can make some money there and then time it just right before this thing falls apart.
Right. And, you know, the number of investors that assume they'll get out of stocks even as the price is moving higher, you know, and they're going to get up just before the next correction. You know what they believe? They believe there will be someone or a whole group of people waiting in line to buy their shares from them when they want to sell.
Okay, let's stop there. You've talked about some axioms, okay? I love axioms because you can say, you know, in the long run, you can count on an axiom. There's another axiom. The axiom of any market is to get out of it, you need someone to buy it.
That's right. If you're a seller, you have to be matched up with a buyer. Otherwise, you're stuck with the product. Now, people don't think about that in relation to stocks. They know it full well in real estate because you can sit on a property for 6 months, a year. I've seen properties on the market for a decade with someone trying to get out. And the only thing they can do is desperately drop the price until they find a bid in the marketplace, an offer from someone to say, I'll buy it at that price. It takes buyers to match with sellers in order for someone to unload a position. This is what people don't appreciate. If you think you are going to be able to get out just before market correction, listen, there's large positions which are unloaded as prices rise in advance of a peak because they are aware that when a peak is reached, part of the dynamics of a peak, what makes it a peak? Is that liquidity dries up. Buyers disappear. The preponderance of market activity becomes liquidations and sellers instead of buyers. And so you've got to keep this in mind. The old adage of selling into strength, it's always wise. It's also the only time that large quantities of product, whether it's paper or otherwise, can be moved without tanking the market.
So Dave, in review, we've talked about the price of gold. We've talked about the creation of paper. We've talked about Europe. We've talked about Putin. But there are some axioms, like you've talked about, that if we just stick to, it always plays out. I think about when this company started, when your mom and dad started this company. Gold was $35 an ounce. Okay, then I came along 15 years later in 1987, and gold was $300 an ounce. And then, you know, we passed the year 2000, went to 2005, and gold was $500 or $600, $700 an ounce. Now gold's $1,200 an ounce. That axiom is playing out, okay? Starting at 35. Now, yeah, there were ups and downs, but really, it's done exactly what it's supposed to do. An ounce of gold buys about a month's worth of food throughout history. If you have an ounce of gold, you've got about a month's worth of food for your family, don't you?
As long as you're not eating foie gras and Saturn. Or
well, okay, not your diet. Yeah,
no, I'm kidding. No, I'd have gout if that was my diet. You know, it's just, you're right, these axioms are important. You can't spend more than you make. So why am I not impressed by the latest consumer credit numbers? $26 billion, the July surprise. I'm not impressed because you can't spend more than you make. And if you assume that the success of this country is built on paying people back money that you now owe them, that's not a success story. That's called debtism. That's called debt slavery.
Right.
Do you understand? I mean, this is not a success story. You can print your way to success, but for only so long. It was Schäuble, the gentleman from the Bank of Germany, who said this week, sure, money printing buys you time, but that's all it does.
It doesn't fix the problem.
No, it's not the tools that we need right now. That's what he was saying this week. He understands that Draghi is going to buy time for Europe, just as the Fed has bought time for the United States, just as the Bank of Japan has bought time for the Japanese. And yet, even after the end of the monetary experiments, what do we have in Japan? A decline of GDP growth by close to 7%. We've got retail sales plummeting as a result of an increase in taxes. They're trying to plug holes. It's a mess. What's the conclusion? It's a mess. And am I comfortable owning gold today? Oh, you bet I am. Do I want to own more ounces? Yes, I have lifetime goals, and they're pretty high marks. I don't know that I will ever reach them. And I'll be aggressively buying for a long time to come. I'll also be aggressively selling when the right time comes. This is just it. Inflation has always been a consequence of money printing. We have massive money printing, have had for 5 years, and it continues unabated. If you want to wait and see if the consequences are different this time, be my guest.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.